Good afternoon, everybody. My name is Tony Giddens, the director of the LSE. It's my great pleasure to welcome you all here this afternoon and to extend a special welcome to our very distinguished guest, the Prime Minister of New Zealand, Helen Clark. Helen, I think, should feel at home in the LSE because she has an academic background herself, having taught political science, and her husband got no fewer than 2 degrees at the LSE, so the LSE is in some sense part of her family. Helen Clark has held offices at all levels of the Labour Party in New Zealand. She has been successively Minister of Conservation, Minister of Housing, and Minister of Health. She became Minister of Labour and Deputy Prime Minister in August 1989. She became Leader of the Opposition in December 1993, and was elected Prime Minister on 27 November 1999. Her lecture today touches on matters of wide interest to us here in the UK and in Europe. From the mid-1980s to the late 1990s, New Zealand was the site of the most far-reaching free market reforms of any industrial country. There are obvious analogues with the Thatcherite period in the UK, save that in New Zealand these policies went further, really, than they ever did here. The title of her talk today, Implementing a Progressive Agenda in a Small Country Over 15 Years of Neoliberalism, appears up there. I'd ask you to give her a very warm LSE welcome, the Prime Minister of New Zealand.
Thank you, Tony, for the welcome and for the invitation to give this lecture today. It is an honour to be here. I recall when I first came to London ever in 1976 on a postgraduate scholarship from New Zealand, I had a reader's card for the LSE Library, and I have spent many hours in the old library at the LSE working on my PhD thesis at the time. Well, to the topic and the background to it. The government that I lead in New Zealand is a minority centre-left coalition made up of a majority Labour Party and a party to our left named the Alliance. We govern with support in our parliament, normally offered by Greens. We took office in 1999, the end of that year, after 15 years of neoliberalism. And there is no doubt in my mind that we were voted into office to bring a change in direction and a better balance in economic and social policy. It should, of course, not be assumed that New Zealand prior to 1984 was a nation in which all was well. Our living standards ranked around third in the world in 1950 when I was born. By the turn of this new century, we ranked well below most European nations in terms of GDP per capita. Older British citizens will remember New Zealand as something like an offshore farm for Britain. And so it was until British entry to the European Union when the door slammed. A large proportion of our exports were, and still are, sourced from the primary sectors, and a large proportion of those used to make their way in commodity form to Britain. Manufacturing had developed in New Zealand under heavy import protection from the 1930s. Its focus, though, was on import substitution. It was not internationally competitive, and our service sector was distinctly underdeveloped prior to 1984. As the world economy changed over the decades, New Zealand simply failed to change with it. Stuck with the old commodity exports and carrying the high costs of local, uncompetitive manufacturing, we sank relative to others. After the oil price shock of 1974, unemployment began rising, along with government budget deficits and current account deficits. When the outgoing Conservative government called an early election for July 1984, it was having difficulty producing a budget. Its last budget deficit had been equivalent to around 8% of GDP. When Labour came to power in 1984, change was certainly called for in New Zealand. At that time, however, third way options were not developed in the Social Democratic menu. and the prescriptions for old Labour didn't exactly fit the bill at that time of economic crisis either. Following the advice given to it by Treasury, heavily influenced by neoliberalism, the new government immediately floated the dollar and then embarked on a programme of far-reaching economic deregulation and restructuring. Farm subsidies were removed, financial markets were opened up, import protection was fairly quickly phased out. Income taxes were cut substantially over the next 4 years from a top marginal rate of 66 cents in the dollar to 33. A broadly based consumption tax came in, initially at 10%, rising to 12.5 in 1989. While no doubt much of what happened had to happen, the pace was very rapid and no thought was given to adjustment mechanisms in those years. As the old industries declined, there was no smart act of government to facilitate the new. The market was king and the level playing field was lauded, even more so from the 1990s when a re-energised party of the right was re-elected and began radical change in social policy and provision as well. The new government in 1991 slashed welfare spending and subsidies on public housing, leaving the poorest New Zealanders an estimated 20 to 25% worse off. That year, the unemployment rate rose into double figures in percentage terms, and for the first time since the depressions of the 1920s and 1930s, a significant level of poverty reappeared in New Zealand. Attempts were made in those years to put the public health system on a commercial footing. The most controversial changes probably were those to the Labour Law, where a new Employment Contracts Act brought substantial deregulation to the labour market and made collective bargaining much more difficult. In the 1990s, the economy marked time, riding the highs and lows of the commodity cycle. A newly independent central bank was required to manage inflation down to a range of 0 to 2% and then maintain it there. The fast transition towards that target, because we had been used to somewhat higher inflation, was accompanied by relatively high interest rates and by a soaring New Zealand dollar. By the mid-1990s, that was adversely affecting export returns. Unemployment under these economic settings seemed destined to bottom out at no lower than 6%. Then in 1998, New Zealand was caught up in the later stages of the Asian financial crisis. The New Zealand dollar fell sharply, the government responded by further cutting spending, and the economy went into recession again for two quarters. It was against this tumultuous background of New Zealand's modern history that our government was elected in November 1999. Many New Zealanders agreed that the country was on the wrong track, and that 15 years of radical change had failed to deliver either prosperity or a fairer society. Nor was there an appetite for any more radical change. Trust in government, and indeed in the whole political system, was at a rather low ebb. The 1980s and 1990s are looked back on as the years of broken promises when governments seemed to pursue agendas which had no public mandate. The level of concern about government's seeming lack of accountability had led to far-reaching change in the electoral system. In 1993, a referendum revealed that more than 80% of New Zealanders wanted to change the electoral system and that the greatest number wanted a German-style proportional representation system. That system, known as MMP, multi-member proportional, was introduced, and the 1996 elections were the first held under it. The election result forced the ruling Conservatives into a coalition with a small populist party. The coalition, which fell apart in the course of the next 3 years, was a shambles and led to disillusionment with the new voting system as well. So, the challenges faced by our new government were not only to build a stronger economy and deliver more social justice, but also to keep our word to the electorate and make a minority coalition government elected under MMP work. Fainter hearts may well have walked away from the task. Fortunately, and unlike 1984, there were new social democratic models at hand. As Tony Giddens has pointed out in his writings, a social democratic revival had been in progress since Bill Clinton took his New Democrat approach to the White House in 1992. The new social democracy began to evolve with national characteristics across a range of countries, including New Labour in Britain, the path taken by Dutch Labour and Coalition, and to a certain degree in Sweden and in France. In Tony Giddens' recent Fabian monograph, We're Now for New Labour, he sets out the characteristics of the new centre-left. In summary, those of us who follow this path have acknowledged the need for fresh thinking to cope with the changes in the world around us, not least of them being the fast pace of globalisation and the emergence of the knowledge economy. We have also determined to appeal to the broad mainstream of the population, which abhors extremes and wants common sense, practical solutions to everyday problems. Today's social democrats operate in an environment where it is critical to maintain the confidence of business for the nation's economic health and critical to carve out the nation's competitive niche in the international economy. That calls for sound macroeconomic policy and for the state to take a leadership role in strategies for economic development, using the full ability it has to be a facilitator, coordinator, and broker, and using its funding powers to maximise investment and participation in education and skills training. The state, of course, can also define the values which are important in a nation's development. In our government, we believe in promoting innovation and enterprise to build economic prosperity. We also believe in being collaborative, compassionate, and inclusive. Taken together, we think these are the values which can enhance both economic and social health in the 21st century. We also have a commitment to promoting sustainability in what we do to preserve options for future generations, and we are influenced by triple bottom line concepts around integrating economic, social, and environmental factors in our decision making. Like New Labour in Britain, New Zealand Labour went into office armed with a pledge card of commitments we were determined to keep to restore faith in the political process. We spent most of our first year in office meeting the commitments, lifting the level of public pension provision, bringing back fair rentals for public housing, making tertiary education more affordable, funding more treatments in the health system, targeting and reducing the incidence of property crime, and growing the number of jobs in the economy. We did defy conventional wisdom in campaigning for and winning on a plank for raising the top tax rate on the top 5% of earners, and that was implemented. We brought in a fairer labour law and brought workers' accident compensation back into the National Social Insurance Scheme, measures very important to our long-time labour constituency. We were also determined to be good managers of the economy. Of course, in the first half of year 2000, we watched with some concern as there was a substantial international currency repositioning occurring to the benefit of the US dollar and the yen and to the detriment of the euro and the Australian and New Zealand dollars. That repositioning, though, did leave us with an extremely export-friendly currency, which in turn has certainly helped to achieve export-led growth. Prior to 11 September, which brought its own shock to the international economy, we could look back with some pleasure on the way the economy was performing. I hasten to add that we have been fortunate in having the commodity cycle run in our favour, the weather run in our favour, which is important, where you have a large agricultural sector, and an extremely friendly dollar for exporting. We were looking at growth in the year to June last of 3.5%, unemployment at 5.2% hit a 13-year low, the current account deficit at 4% of GDP was at an 8-year low and falling, it's now around 3.4%. The trade balance turned positive from last July for the first time in 6 years, and business and consumer confidence was reasonably steady. Of course, 11 September brought with it a period of uncertainty, but New Zealand was in a better position than most to cope with it. Our low inflation, low government debt and strong fiscal position all help, and we look set to continue to outperform our trading partners this year. But outperforming our trading partners is something New Zealand needs to do year in and year out for many years if we are to lift our per capita income back into the top half of the OECD ranking, where we think we can be. In terms of real per capita GDP, New Zealand ranked 9th in the OECD in 1970, 18th in 1986, and 20th in 1999. Between 1986 and 1999, New Zealand's real GDP per capita grew by 9.5% compared to an OECD average of 29%. What we've been stressing in government is the need to speed up New Zealand's economic transformation so that we continue to lessen our dependence on commodity exports with their exposure to considerable price and climatic fluctuations and move up the value chain in everything that we do. We know that the nations which prosper in the 21st century will be those which have the capacity to create new knowledge, adapt new knowledge, apply it to new and existing industries. We know that New Zealand has the capacity to be one of those nations. Indeed, our position on other key OECD indicators would suggest we have the preconditions for economic takeoff if we focus our energy on it. For example, we have the sixth highest level of participation in early childhood education in the OECD. We are ranked 11th out of 28 in the proportion of the population aged 25 to 64, which has at least an upper secondary educational qualification, and 14th in the proportion which has completed tertiary qualifications to a bachelor's degree level or higher. Our literacy levels measure very well by OECD standards. In 1999 and 2000, we were well in the top half of the OECD for employment rates, and in 2000, we ranked 9th in the OECD in the proportion of the population with access to the internet. The legacy of the 1980s and 1990s was a state which played a hands-off role in economic development. A level playing field was created with low tax rates and a deregulated economy. But as other nations tilted their playing fields, as the pace of globalization quickened, and as talented New Zealanders were recruited to fill other nations' skills shortages, New Zealand lost out. Our share of the world's foreign direct investment fell, and significant companies, often a new foreign ownership, relocated offshore. Our government has had to start from scratch in developing smart, active strategies for the economy. The path we're taking sees us place more emphasis than ever on education and skills training, on supporting science, research and development, on initiatives to back business, industry and regional growth, and on attracting greenfields foreign direct investment. In developing the strategies, we've looked at models elsewhere, from those of Ireland, Finland and Israel to Singapore, Korea and Silicon Valley. From them, we borrow what we believe will work for New Zealand. Last week, we issued the government's policy framework for growing an innovative New Zealand. It sets out the vision we have for an innovative, inclusive and sustainable nation, the initiatives we've already taken to get there, and areas which need to be further developed. We're setting out a vision which sees New Zealand as a land where diversity will be valued and reflected in our national identity, a great place to live, learn, work and do business, a birthplace of world-changing people and ideas, and a place where people invest in the future. The aim is to speed up development of high growth, high value, internationally competitive sectors, which not only create opportunities for well-paid and satisfying work, but which also create the wealth to fund first world services and infrastructure. If you keep falling down those OECD rankings, your ability to fund such infrastructure and services eventually comes into question. For New Zealand, it's critical that new economy concepts also drive our primary sectors, from which some 60% of our exports are still sourced. At the production level, those sectors have long been highly innovative, and increasingly more of their exports are moving to branded and higher value product. The tourism industry, which ranks alongside the dairy industry as an export dollar earner, also offers a range of high value, sophisticated and specialised products. Other internationally competitive export-oriented industries have also developed in recent years on the raised earth left by economic restructuring. Significant export earnings are coming from information and communications technology, niche manufacturing, film and television, leisure marine industries, fashion and design, aquaculture, wine, and other new sectors. Education has gone from being a very low, minimal earner of foreign exchange a decade ago to almost a $1 billion earner today, and will grow further. Increasing depth and improved performance in a wider range of export-oriented industries goes some way to explaining the turn-up in New Zealand's fortunes. A sign of how much our economy is changing can be found in the prediction that our information and communications technology clusters will, within 3 to 5 years, equal the export earnings of the wool industry, once New Zealand's leading export industry. So what specifically are we doing to drive innovation in the economy further and faster? We're promoting now initiatives in 4 key areas in an endeavour to get a step change in the rate of growth. The first and paramount, developing skills and talent. We undertake to invest as much as we can in education and industry training, to keep adapting our immigration policies so that they help rather than hinder the search for specialist talent and skills, and to enlist the talents of New Zealanders living offshore. In education, we've lifted numbers in early childhood education, stressed the basics in literacy and numeracy, and made a quantum leap in getting ICT into the schools with the help of leading companies there. Big change is underway in tertiary education to promote world-class research and more collaboration across institutions. We're making decisions now on which programs will get new funding to produce centres of research excellence. A national tertiary education strategy is being developed for the first time to get better alignment between tertiary education and New Zealand's developmental goals. And I stress those goals cover not just the economic, but also the social, environmental and cultural as well. A new tertiary education commission will implement the strategy and make funding allocations in line with it. Extra funding for industry training has produced an 11% growth in the numbers participating in the first year we were in office, and we have a new modern apprenticeship program set up to make work-based trade and technical training more attractive, which has been very successful. We do live in a global labour market where skills and talents are at a premium everywhere. As fast as other nations recruit our talented people, we have to try to recruit back. In the past, New Zealand's immigration policy focused more on how to keep people out than let them in. Now we're launching a new talent visa and skills shortage work permits so that skilled people in areas of shortage can be accessed more quickly than ever before. We have had in recent months a surge of migration to New Zealand, which includes a lot of returning New Zealanders. We're also seeing the expatriate New Zealand community as a very big resource to draw on, and we're aiming to build networks of those expatriates and to use them for opportunities for exchanges and mentoring for young talented people and entrepreneurs. Secondly, there's the whole area of enhancing New Zealand's innovation system. We lifted government science and research funding substantially and improved the tax treatment of private sector R&D to try to encourage more of it. Like all Western nations, we want to see more of our people's discoveries and innovations earning wealth for our own country. To that end, we've set up an incubator support program and a venture investment fund to provide seed and startup capital for new businesses. This was an area where there was a lack of market provision. We've gone from having no business incubators 2 years ago to somewhere between 12 and 18 now, depending on how you count. They are developing mainly around the major universities and polytechnics, and are linked, of course, to the staff and services of those institutions, which helps. We're doing more work now on how to drive forward clusters of innovative industries, how to incentivise our research institutions to commercialise more of their research, how to improve the intellectual property framework so we get this full value of our innovations. Then there's the area of increasing New Zealand's global connectedness. And we're focusing here on how to attract quality foreign investment, more aggressively promote our exports, and improve our national branding. Presently, the investment attraction and recruitment activities of government straddle two agencies, our trade board and a new economic development agency called Industry New Zealand. It's thought that probably we need to bring functions together into a single purpose investment promotion authority to get a better result, and we're having a look at what the best shape for structures would be. We have increased the funding going into attracting investment, and our agencies are now able to work with major investors to put packages together to encourage them to come to New Zealand. I stress New Zealand is new at this game, a game which many other nations and regions of nations have played for years, but the early signs are encouraging. We've been very active on the trade and export promotion front, involving new funding and the establishment again of an export credit office to enable exporters to access credit guarantees to back their bids for contracts in difficult markets. Most other Western nations provide this kind of backing for their exporters, and we have had to reinvent it. We have new business grow programs to provide support for companies with the capacity to grow their exports quickly. And we're now looking at a beachhead program whereby our trade board will make premises available abroad for new exporters as forward marketing bases and as incubators for small and medium-sized businesses establishing themselves offshore. We've already facilitated a New Zealand presence at a Singapore technology park. We put a lot of effort as a government into improving market access for our exports through our trade policy work, through pursuing bilateral trade agreements, and through ministerial and prime ministerial-led business missions abroad. We've also got a lot of work to do in rebranding New Zealand's image to align it with contemporary reality. The popular image of New Zealand is of a clean, green, and beautiful country with rather a lot of sheep. It is all of that, but it is also a dynamic 21st century country with sophisticated cities and a vibrant arts and cultural life. We'll be working with the private sector to try to develop a consistent brand image of New Zealand across all industry sectors so that to the clean and green image we add smart and innovative. We're currently investing quite a lot in leveraging benefit for New Zealand off the release of The Lord of the Rings, the largest ever movie production filmed in New Zealand and made by New Zealanders, and off the second defence by New Zealanders of Yachting's premier trophy, the America's Cup. Both events can help promote New Zealand as technologically advanced, creative and successful. Then we come to how to focus the government's resources. We've decided to focus on three areas to speed up growth and innovation. Each of the areas not only has considerable growth potential in itself, but also has high potential spillover effects for other sectors of the economy. The consensus of advice we've had on sector targeting is that government should focus on areas which are capable of having a material impact on growth rates across the board, which are capable of developing world-class specialisation and scale, and which contribute to the vision of a globally oriented innovative economy. Those criteria led us to conclude that promotion of biotechnology, information and communications technology, and creative industries was most likely to help move New Zealand onto a higher growth plane. Biotechnology, for example, has spillover effects for the primary sectors and the processing of their goods, and for the pharmaceutical and other industries. Information and communications technology helps drive the modernisation of the entire economic and social infrastructure and is an essential part of making e-commerce a reality. creative industries not only underpin the effective branding and marketing of all New Zealand goods and services, but also can, through areas such as design, have a major impact on industrial output. We're now moving to establish joint public-private sector task forces to identify the strategic opportunities in these areas, and we'll be looking to see that our government departments and agencies prioritise the development of these areas in their policies and programs. So, for example, both government and private sector would need to give priority to developing the skills needed in those areas. Research there will be encouraged, innovation initiatives will be focused there, and appropriate foreign direct investment would be targeted there. Obviously, that focus isn't at the expense of other strategies underway to boost other key areas of the economy. Our government, starting from scratch, has been an active facilitator of business, industry and regional growth generally, with many new programs being driven through a Ministry of Economic Development and the New Industry New Zealand. The Growth and Innovation Framework, though, sets out new directions and priorities which will impact on the forthcoming and future budgets. We did develop the framework as a result of a working public-private sector partnership, and we will be continuing to work closely with the private sector on the implementation of initiatives. We're moving now to establish an advisory board with private sector representation to advise us on progress and new initiatives which should be taken. What is happening, I think, is you're seeing the development in New Zealand of a new economic agenda and a substantially shared vision of what the future can be. There are, of course, still those in the business community who hanker after ever lower taxes and more deregulation as the key economic prescription, and who can be surprised at that coming out of an era of neoliberalism. But I believe many are now seeing the strategic focus the government is adopting and the policy interventions which accompany it as more likely to contribute to sustained growth. New Zealand already offers a very substantial degree of economic freedom and a low cost of doing business relative to other Western economies. It is important to our centre-left government, and I think to most New Zealanders, that decent environmental and labour standards are maintained in the drive for a high-value and sustainable economy. Indeed, we see the development of a stronger economy as only a means to an end. The end is higher living standards and the ability to provide a better quality of life for all people. An inclusive and cohesive society is an essential building block for growing an innovative economy. We are fortunate that we've been able to run a strong fiscal policy while also investing more heavily in the social areas and core services, in the environment and conservation, and in the arts, culture, and sport. My lecture today is focused very much on what we're doing to get growth and development in New Zealand onto a higher plane. But it's also worth commenting on the style of government we've adopted, which differs a great deal from the general indifference which neoliberals tend to display towards civil society. We set out to develop an inclusive style which sees us engaging and running conversations and partnerships with different sectors. For example, we've established a joint central government, local government forum which meets 6 monthly, which I co-chair, to discuss policy in all the areas where we must interact with local government: transport planning, environmental management, regional development, forthcoming legislation. This is a huge difference from the past, where central government and local government always fought. Borrowing from a British New Labour initiative and building on our long-standing contacts with NGOs, we began work on developing a protocol for relationships between central government and NGOs. As in most Western societies, a great deal of social program delivery in New Zealand is done by NGOs. We have, of course, long-standing relationships with labour unions, as we are a Labour Party. After an initial standoff with business, much of which was somewhat resistant to the change of direction we brought, we have been able to develop a good dialogue which has resulted in more mutual respect, if not always agreement. I've already referred to the specific support from the private sector, which we've had in developing digital initiatives in education and the growth and innovation framework. Then there is a relationship which is unique to New Zealand, which we are building between our government and Māoridom. Māoridom has undergone a renaissance, and its drive for self-determination sees it wishing to develop its own approaches to economic and social development, generally at an iwi, a tribal, or hapu sub-tribal level. Mainstream economic and social programs have not worked well for Māori, and the government is more than willing to be a partner in new approaches. We focus on supporting the building of capacity of Māori organisations to strategise and to implement programs, and we fund programs delivered by Māori for Māori. Our experience with Māoridom also helps us develop partnerships and programs with and for the significant Pacific peoples population in New Zealand and for the other growing ethnic minority communities. So you can see that our engagement with civil society is rather diverse. From my lecture today, I hope it will be apparent that the coalition government in New Zealand is following a path parallel to those of other modernising centre-left governments. We do seek, in Professor Giddens' words, to reconcile social justice with an energetic and competitive economy. Our nation's modern history has been one of relative decline. From the contentment and prosperity of the early 1950s, New Zealand failed to innovate and renew its economy and institutions. Change, when it came from 1984, lacked balance, produced growing inequity, failed to deliver a turnaround, and lacked popular support. Now we've made a fresh start with the advantage of learning from others who've taken third way approaches. I go from here to Stockholm tonight to a meeting of the Progressive Governance Group of Leaders to swap ideas on how to meet the economic, social, and international challenges which face us all. Our government came to office determined to restore a sense of fairness, to build opportunity for New Zealand and New Zealanders, and to guarantee security for older New Zealanders, for families, and for those in adversity. While I've had little time today to comment on our social agenda, it has been substantial. Later this year, we go to the next election, standing on our record of providing strong leadership, a clear direction, a growing economy, and major investment in the basic needs of New Zealanders for education, health, housing, and superannuation. We also have major environmental initiatives to our credit. We're committed philosophically to a country in which people of all backgrounds, abilities, gender, beliefs, and orientations have a fair go. And we have a program of action to grow an innovative and sustainable economy which can support a higher quality of life for all our people. Thank you again for the opportunity to tell you about some of the steps we're taking to implement a progressive agenda for New Zealand after some rather bleak years in the recent past. Thank you.
The Prime Minister has kindly said that she'll take questions for a quarter of an hour. She has to leave pretty sharp at 3:30. There should be roving mics around the room, so Helen, I don't know if you want to pick your own questioners or...
If I can see them.
Well, there are plenty around in the front row there. There's one at the back.
Okay. Robert.
I'm Robert Wade, Professor of Political Economy at LSE and a New Zealander. And just before I ask my question, I wanted to say that the New Zealand case, it seems to me so interesting that we should explore the possibility of creating an LSE New Zealand society so that at the end of this session, I will remain behind and anybody here who's interested in that idea should come up and we will coordinate this project.
Didn't believe in entrepreneurship, Roger.
I what?
That's all right, doesn't matter.
Do you believe in entrepreneurship?
My question is, could you say a bit more about what was the attitude of the New Zealand Treasury, the key civil service organisation, to your government's attempt to change direction?
Well, the Treasury is also undergoing a reorientation. And perhaps to most people's great amazement, they produced a report a few months ago on an inclusive economy. Now, their thinking is still developing. And in any case, I think it's important that politicians lead, not bureaucrats. And we do set out to lead. But I would say that in the selection of the last secretary for the Treasury, someone from outside the bureaucracy was chosen. I think he's been able to bring a more flexible touch than had been, you know, the case for many, many years before that. I mean, instinctively, you know, the Treasury really doesn't like the government getting in and doing a lot. But then this sort of social democratic management is not about the heavy hand of the state. I think everyone realises that in, you know, the early 21st century, where you've got to be globally competitive, you've got to take the confidence of business with you, the path forward for a government like ours is to try and form decent working relationships, partnerships across a whole range of sectors, including business. So it's not about the heavy hand of the state doing a lot more. It's about the state saying, how can we best direct the resources we've got, the skills we've got, to move development along? It's a more collaborative approach, perhaps, than, you know, the school of old Labour politics that most of us grew up in. As I say, of the sort of models that are around now, been available in 1984, one likes to think that New Zealand wouldn't have lurched off down the path that it took at that time, that there would have been, you know, better ways of dealing with it for the kinds of outcomes that we want.
My name is Jim Kennedy. Prime Minister, some of us were quite astonished by the changes in the broadcasting sector in New Zealand during the 90s. I wonder whether your government has formulated some policy in this sector.
Yes, there's big change going on with television, with radio, public radio. Talking of broadcasting. Radio New Zealand used to have a strong commercial arm. That was sold at some point, I think, in the 90s, can't remember the exact time. And the core Radio New Zealand, public radio, was left with a sort of national program like BBC Radio 1 or whatever. And a concert program, and commercial radio went its own way. We have probably more commercial radio stations per head of population anywhere in the world. It's vastly deregulated, and most of it's rubbish, of course. and it's a great pleasure in Auckland to be able to tune into BBC World as you drive around the car. But with television, the television model that was set up saw the state television company also on a commercial model. And in the 90s, I think it's probably fair to say it was being prepared for sale, so it got more and more commercial and less public interest television, if you like. And what we've done is develop a charter for Television New Zealand, which runs parallel, if you like, to the radio charter, public radio charter. And Television New Zealand will be required to reflect more of the news, perspectives, stories, heritage, etc. of New Zealand, arts and culture, than it has hitherto. You know, and we ended up having state television, which was indistinguishable, really, from private commercial television. At that point, you start to say, well, what is the point? There isn't much point. So, there is big change, and of course, it's been fought and resisted all the way from those who dedicated themselves to running it the other way, but I'm optimistic about the outcome.
Andrew Gumman, expat New Zealander. In fact, I used to be in one of your tutorials 20 years ago.
It must have been. This you is my 21st year in Parliament.
Do you see the tyranny of distance for New Zealand, as an advantage or disadvantage in terms of lifting New Zealand's economic performance in the future?
Of course, in terms of quality of life, it's a great advantage. But I think that the communications revolution means the tyranny of distance really shouldn't be the problem that it was. If you're moving to the sort of economy I'm describing of niche industries, a lot more innovation, it's possible to do that from anywhere in the world. And while we've suffered a bit from the New Zealand companies that got big wanting to move closer to their key markets, I think fundamentally there has to be a place for small, smart, active countries like New Zealand if we position ourselves the right way, recruit talent, attract people the right way. So there's nothing you can do about your geography. It's just where it happens to be. So you have to do your best to turn it to your advantage.
Ms. Clark, I'm also a New Zealander, Stephanie Heyman. I spoke to a member of my family this morning asking if she had a question she'd like to direct at you, and she said, not at all, but just to make damn sure you got back at the next election. So my own question centres on the fact, I was very pleased to hear you referred to Māoridom, and it centres on the fact that you returned to Waitangi this year. When you looked at the assembled gathering, how do you feel that you are going to be able to bring Māoridom into this inclusive society you wish to achieve?
Well, I think one can only be enormously encouraged by what's happening in Māoridom. There has been an enormous renaissance and a real desire by Māoridom to determine its own path and destiny, at which point I think the appropriate role for a government like ours is to say, well, how can we partner and support it? And that's what we're doing. We have a lot of initiatives, as I say, to build capacity, because with Māoridom wanting to get up and run fast in taking responsibility for economic development, social development, you have to support organisations to develop the depth and strength to do that in a way which will get the results that they're looking for. So quite a lot of work going into strengthening that capacity. But then, as I say, there's increasingly a lot of social provision, which is done directly by Māori, for Māori, which we fund. What we've learned is that the mainstream just doesn't cater for everybody. It doesn't produce results. If it did, Māori wouldn't have the worst economic and social indicators of anyone in the society. So I think that it's really looking extremely positive, and a lot of things are happening. There's a lot of enthusiasm.
You talk about setting up an expat network. Can you elaborate on what that'll be and how you'll plan to implement it?
Yeah, there's been a lot of thinking about how you could draw on the talents of expatriate New Zealanders. And I suppose, the first instinct of a lot of countries is to say, damn them, they've gone. But actually, when you've got as many have gone as New Zealand's got, you're better to embrace people, I think. And of course, New Zealanders who've gone and stayed away are a pretty talented bunch of people who've done extremely well, and they have a lot of contacts, which, if we kept in touch with people, might end up being of a lot of use to New Zealand. So, and of course, there's always a chance you persuade a few to come home and do the sort of things they've done overseas at home as well. So the idea is to try to establish networks where we can keep in touch. And where it might be possible for New Zealanders who are well placed overseas to be providing opportunities for talented young New Zealanders to come and get experience, perhaps some form of mentoring for people in the business community, to up-and-coming New Zealand entrepreneurs, a bit of a leg up, use the contact networks. Quite a lot of work and thinking has been done around it. And of course, if Robert gets a list, I hope he'll share it.
Prime Minister, you've mentioned reform of the constitution briefly. What are your plans for installation of a republic instead of the monarchy?
You asked this question as the Queen sets foot in New Zealand for the Jubilee Tour. Well, you know, one of the first newspaper headlines I got in a Sunday paper as a new Prime Minister was, PM says monarchy absurd. I thought, did I say that? Well, I did say something close to that. I said that the notion of a nation like New Zealand at the end of the 20th century having a hereditary head of state 12,000 miles away was prima facie absurd, which of course it is. Now, having said that, there's not a sort of great urge for change in New Zealand. And some people say it's the cheapest head of state you'll ever get. to all intents and purposes, the nominal head of state is the Governor General, appointed by the government to represent the Queen. And she carries out the sort of, you know, nominal duties that the Queen would perform were she there, and sort of nominal duties the Queen performs here in Britain. It is inevitable, of course, that New Zealand will become a republic. The question is when most of the country is frankly totally uninterested in the subject. And what I think the most likely path is that at some point Australia will again elect a Labor government. It nearly did last year, but then there was a certain crisis to the north of Australia which changed political debate away from economic and social issues and onto other issues. And Labor now controls every state and territory in Australia, but not the federal government. But Labor in Australia is a Republican Party. It will undoubtedly, when it regains power, which it will at some point, run a referendum, which will carry to make Australia a republic. Now, at that point, the spotlight's going to come on to New Zealand. What will New Zealand do? And I might say the spotlight also then goes on to Canada. And both Canada and New Zealand have got particular difficulties in the way of making the transition. For New Zealand, one of the most vexed issues is how to guarantee the treaty relationship in a new Republican constitution. And that's going to take a bit more thinking yet. Canada's got different issues around its states and Indigenous people as well. But it will happen. It's just a question of when, whether it's the 10 years, the 20. I'd actually recognise the lady with the red hair.
Could you please say something about the role of women in politics in New Zealand and what policies you think parties should pursue to bring more women into positions of electoral office?
Well, we do have quite a lot of say. you know, I think we've got to around 30% of our parliament is female, and around, 8 of our 20 ministers are women, 20 cabinet ministers, plus another 3 in the outer cabinet. And women, we had simultaneously women as prime minister and leader of the opposition. We swapped roles in 1999. And we have a woman chief justice, the attorney general's a woman, the governor general's a woman, head of the largest corporation's a woman. Most of the professional societies like law, accountancy and so on have had their first woman presidents, if not onto their second. So women are, you know, increasingly pretty well represented in the national life. In terms of parties, you know, I think Labor here made a great progress when it had the quota system, and it required, I think, that in its safe seats that a very significant proportion have only women-only shortlists, and then some minor tribunal said this was a terrible breach of a Bill of Rights or something. But I think that really enabled the party here to make a quantum leap, and I think some sort of affirmative action has to be practiced if you're to really make a change. In New Zealand, the change came without quotas. We got to 20% of MPs being female without proportional representation, but then when proportional representation came, it leapt up to 30% in one election, and that's because you have a list system. Now, women traditionally find it harder to become the candidates in safe seats for their party and first past the post systems. It's the same in Britain, same in the States, Australia, and in New Zealand, because the image of the MP traditionally was the male family man, and that sort of knocked out anybody who didn't meet that image. Now, that can change slowly, it can change faster with affirmative action, but when you come to lists under proportional representation, if parties want to have women take them seriously, they can't offer all male lists. And so we started seeing, you know, female representation in parties which really had very little prominence for women in them, and that has made a difference. Undoubtedly, it's easier under proportional representation to change the numbers quickly.
I promise I think this will be the last question, given your schedule. One more question.
I've got a question about your policy on refugees. Has Australia's rather restrictive policy on refugees had any impact on your own? And have you become like sort of a safe haven for refugees, or are you restricting access to your country for those people as well now?
Well, there's a couple of issues here. Firstly, New Zealand has an annual refugee quota with the UN High Commission for Refugees, so each year we aim to fill that quota. Now, over and above that, we have a steady trickle of people who arrive at our border by plane and claim refugee status, or they may have come in under some visa-free or other arrangement and then claim refugee status when they get to New Zealand. We assess those people for eligibility as refugees. The proportion that qualify is actually quite small, about 18% over the last year for which we have figures. And that's because we had visa-free entry from, say, Thailand, and a number of Thais came and claimed refugee status, which there was no basis for. And we also had quite a lot of claims from Czech gypsies, which couldn't really be sustained either. But what largely isolates New Zealand from the sorts of pressures that Australia's had and continental Europe's had is that we are a damn long way from anywhere. You know, we are we're 8,000 kilometres from Singapore. So that means, you know, the Indonesian islands, which are the jumping off points for the criminal trade and people smuggling, are a very long way from New Zealand. For Australia, they haven't got very far to go before they've hit Christmas Island or the Ashmore Reef. And what they do is price in the fare of these terrible old boats, the cost of the terrible old boats being scuttled into the fare they charge people. So to get to New Zealand would require a very large boat. It would be a boat that they would want to have returned, and we are now breathing very, very heavily against the criminal trade. We will confiscate any boat that turns up, and we are now moving to ratify the UN Convention on Transnational Crime Protocols on People Smuggling, which enables us to put very heavy penalties on the crew of a boat that would seek to land people in New Zealand, and to impose a heavy fine. Now, having said all that, with asylum seekers, we have not followed the detention approach of Australia. We have, prior to our government coming in, there was quite a backlog of asylum seekers seeking processing. And the New Zealand way actually was to send people into the community, give them a work permit and hope they would fend for themselves through the process, which by and large they did. And I guess that often leads to marrying a local and sort of finding other ways of staying anyway. But have now got our processing down to, you know, a very short period, and basically we aim to turn around people who don't qualify as refugees pretty quickly and get them on their way again, but the genuine people we resettle. But it has been a different approach, and some might say, well, you've got the luxury of not having hundreds turn up at a time, but that's the way we do it.
Can I ask everyone to stay in their seats until the Prime Minister and a party have left the lecture hall? In the meantime, it's very good of her to break into her schedule to find time to come to the LSE. Please give her a very good hand. Thanks very much.
Thank you.